This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 25, I Fought the Law. Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach podcast. As always, Michael and Angie are in the house.
Hello.
How are you doing today, Ange?
I'm good. It's a weekend.
It is a weekend.
For us, that means nothing.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Except for the entire house is full of people.
We are doing a birthday party today, though. That's kind
of
cool.
We are. It's a combined birthday party.
Yeah, yeah. So that'll be fun, maybe.
It'll be fun.
It'll be all right. It'll be good.
Earplugs.
Yeah, we're definitely taking earplugs, I think.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some writer fun.
Yeah, adult writer fun.
Yeah, we've been working on this masterclass. Talk a little bit about your masterclass, Anne.
Sure. For quite some time, by the way, it's been in development, and we are launching The Secrets to Writing a Page-Turning Story and Landing Your Book Deal.
The secrets to writing a page-turning story and landing your book deal.
Because, you know, we've all seen, you know, one of those happen without the other. We've seen books come out that were not page-turning.
Yeah.
And, you know, the author landed a book deal and... You know, this is something they might, and they may regret this later, you know. And, you know, lots of us have stories that we've packed away that we don't quite get what's not working about them, rejection after rejection, or not finished, et cetera.
Okay.
So it's also like, how do you do both of those? How do you write a page-turning story? Not just any story.
Yeah.
One that agents, literary agents, publishing professionals, acquisitions editors are going to be interested in, and that readers are going to become fans, and be excited for that next book to come out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are you going to cover on the webinar?
So the first thing that we're going to cover are the four reasons that most writers fail. And, you know, there's an interesting thing about that word, fail. I don't actually believe in failure, but, you know, there's the short way and then there's the long way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it doesn't work just to identify the four reasons that most writers fail. But, you know, it's like running into a brick wall. You can keep coming up against that obstacle and you can keep pounding that brick wall, or you can navigate around that. So, you know, this is to give you access to the shortest paths, you know, and how to circumnavigate around the horn so that you finish that manuscript, so that you have writing time, so that you can see all the parts of the story that are working, not working, all of that.
Okay, cool. And what else?
And we're going to go over the top five reasons to write your book. Sometimes, you know, we look at it like one big lump, like, okay, I'm going to write my book. There are actually pathways to getting that book finished and in a publisher's hands that are determined by why you're writing that book. So we're going to go over the five reasons to write a book.
Okay.
And we're also going to cover then, what are the pathways to getting that book finished?
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And what is the duration of said masterclass?
1 hour.
1 hour. And what is the cost of said masterclass?
Free. Free.
Free.
Free. No charge. Which doesn't mean, you know, you don't want to relate to this like, oh, it's free. So free content and, you know, how we do free advice. You know, we tend to relate to something free like it has zero value.
Yeah.
Not the case.
No, this is actually something that is incredible. And obviously, Angie and I have been working on together. And I can tell you that content is great. And you will find extraordinary value in this masterclass. So to find this masterclass, what you're going to do is go to CallliopeWritingCoach.com/webinar. And that'll put you on our landing page where you can select the time that works the best for you. And we'll have one coming soon.
I want to say something about the word webinar. I know it's a bad word. I know it's a naughty word.
Yeah.
I know that people relate to webinar like, you know, oh no, another thing that, you know, really they're not going to give me any value. It's going to be a sales pitch. I will tell you, we are going to be providing you some offerings, but, you know, we're really responsible about giving you huge value.
Absolutely.
Right. And then, you know, a few minutes at the end to register into what might be next for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anything else that you need to say about that?
I want to go back to birthday parties for a minute.
Birthday parties?
Yeah. We opened with talking about going to a birthday party today.
Okay.
And? That's right. A big birthday party. So I'm going to give you a little teaser here. We're going to be talking about epic birthday parties.
Epic birthday parties.
Okay, as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. Thank you, Angie. And now on to our interview with Mr. Michael Glassford.
I'm excited.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. Michael Sheen and Angie Fenimore in the house. And today we have a very special guest with us. We've got Michael Glassford. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Glad Is it Michael or Mike?
It's whatever you want to call me for dinner.
Hey, you know, we're going formal. You know, as I'm looking at the bio, it says Michael Glassford writes petitions by day and adventure stories by night. He majored in English at BYU before obtaining his Juris Doctorate from Washburn Law. For the last 12 years, he has practiced law in Missouri and now in Utah. Michael's exciting debut, YA adventure, Fog of Fortune, was self-published in 2014. He plans on releasing a legal nonfiction self-help entitled You Failed at Marriage, Don't Fail at Divorce this spring. Book 2 of the Silver Sword Chronicles, Quicksilver, is also coming soon. He's currently working on a YA fantasy, Uncommon, and another legal nonfiction dealing with business. Michael's firm, Legal Inc., focuses on helping writers form and run their businesses. He also does freelance editing for Rockword Editing and Heather Moore at Precision Editing Group. Welcome, Michael. It's exciting to have you.
Thanks again.
When do you have any spare time?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. When do you write? That's what I want to know.
I didn't put that in the bio. There's not a lot of spare time.
There doesn't sound like there's any spare time whatsoever. You've got kind of a busy, full life.
So I took off all the apps of my phone, so I don't have any games. There's no Candy Crush. Oh. There's no Angry Birds. The 5 minutes here and there that I would play those games, that's when I jot down ideas and write.
Yeah?
Okay. What about reading?
In the car.
Or consuming.
Books on tape.
Right.
Books okay. on tape. Good.
Then, or consuming story.
I do. I set up a little reading nook in front of my fireplace this winter, so I've actually gotten
so
a lot
great.
Of reading in.
Oh, cool.
You know, you make time and you make a venue for it, and it seems to happen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I get that. It's like I recently discovered that I have been so, what was the word that I used? It was like the perfect word. Oh, I can't say
Oh,
it.
I can think of lots of words.
No,
but I don't
I'm
think
like,
it's the word you're
because
thinking
I've
of.
Got, because I'm doing private clients, like I'm somebody else's bitch. Right, so I know I can't say that. So anyway, I've reconnected to writing, and I forgot some things about myself. I like started writing, like it started just like coming out of me on yellow notepad, and mechanical pencil.
And not like the good mechanical pencil.
No.
These are like the
Kadoozles.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for second graders.
Uh-huh.
They're short. They're little.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what I discovered was, like, I got reconnected to it. I got so busy that I actually haven't been producing a lot of my own stuff. I've been supporting others and training others, which means that, you know, my hands are in it. But anyway, so.
I feel that way a lot. I actually started journaling recently, too.
Oh, did you?
And that just stems into other things, like I journaled, and so now I want to write more about that topic, or
mm-hmm.
So it's been very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So you've actually done quite a bit of writing, and even just recently with your new nonfiction, you're close to finishing that.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It's in the second half of the book, finishing my own edits before I send it off to the editor.
Yeah. Yeah. And give me the title again. You failed it.
It's you failed at marriage, don't fail at divorce.
God, yeah. So talk a little bit about that.
Cheek,
yeah.
You know, maybe it means a little more than what you thought. You know, it's funny at first, but there's some depth to it.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of the book is it's the counsel that I've given my clients for the last 12 years mixed in with my own divorce story from a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So, I open up, I share some vulnerability of me and then apply it and how I use my own advice that I give to my clients in my own situation and how that's worked out and how it's working out for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What better guinea pig than me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that on the heels of your YA fiction story, right?
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the difference between writing this YA fantasy fiction about pirates and then going totally personal with your nonfiction.
Right. Well, there are some writers who can, you know what I mean? They are absolutely fantasy writers. That's what they are. Or they are absolutely, romance. And, kind of dabble here and there. So, I'm curious about the cross genre and your experience of that and writing that and, what you've noticed.
I'm curious too. That's why I asked him the question.
Did you ask that question?
That's exactly the question that I just asked.
Oh, man, where was I?
So what I found is the first book was the Fog of Fortune is historical fiction, and I wrote it like a plausible history. It could have happened. Mm-hmm. So there's no fantasy, there's no magic. That I purposefully stayed away from that because at the time Pirates of the Caribbean was really popular, and I wanted to be a little bit different than them. And as I've gone back, or as I've had readers give me feedback, they tell me that they can really hear me. If they know me, then they can hear me in the book. And mm-hmm. So there's not that much difference in writing the historical fiction because I put me into it. And then, this nonfiction legal self-help, which has got a lot of me as well.
Yeah.
I guess just be self-centered and you can write pretty consistent.
Be self-centered. Be a pirate. Right?
Pirate, attorney, that's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, well, I would think there are some definite
economies of scale.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Good. So one of the things that I know that, when we have our writers' conference and we have you come present there, talk a little bit about the legal side of writing. This is something that I don't think we get a lot of focus on, and I don't think a lot of people understand, the legality of the entire process.
Well, there's so much that goes into it, and as a self-published person or even a person that's going traditionally published creates their team, I really strongly feel that an attorney should be a literary attorney,
mm-hmm.
should be a part of that team to some degree, to have some oversight, to have some input, because there's so many topics. There's copyright, there's the intellectual property in and of itself, there's running your business, and a lot of people don't realize once I've written a book, now I have to create a business. I have to funnel monies into mm-hmm. an account. I have mm-hmm. to make sure those monies don't commingle with my private money. I, mm-hmm. I have to make sure that I have a sales tax number because, it could be up to like $1,500 fine per sales transaction that wasn't reported. And, sell 40 books at Comic-Con, you can find yourself in trouble.
Yeah.
Things that they just don't think about or I like to say they don't know enough to know. And so mm-hmm. it's really a good idea to have that attorney that knows the literary world be able to say, well, what are you doing right now? Kind of give a synopsis of their business plan and say, well, it'd be helpful if you focused on this or if you thought about that. And it doesn't have to be expensive. It could be an hour of the attorney's time. I usually cut my rates in half for writers because I get it.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So... preventative law is always cheaper than fixing it after the fact, after uh-huh. you've been sued or after you're in trouble, because that's going to cost you a lot of money. Case in point, I had an artist come to me and said, I need you to review my contract that I give to people. And I did, and I charged him $75. And he's got a great contract now. Had another guy that didn't do that, and now there's an infringement issue, and the upfront was going to be like $10,000 to go to court.
Mm.
And I think he wished he would have paid $75.
Yeah, that would have been a good investment for sure.
Yeah, something that I wish that I would have known was sheltering money, because something that can happen with authors is you get money in big chunks and then nothing for a long time. And so, I was taxed like I was wealthy, and then you know, nothing for a long time, right? And so I would have liked to have known some ways to handle that before. Before it happened.
And that's just it. You know, everyone says, well, I hear it a lot at writing conferences. Well, don't worry about forming your business until you're making some good money in the business.
And that's, yeah, I disagree.
It's a fallacy because you don't know when it's going to come.
Exactly. Yeah.
You want your foundation to be set up. The example I give is, you know, when they built Rome, they built a huge sewer system. So when the stuff comes, there's somewhere for it to go.
Yeah, excellent. Because
it's too late once it's there.
Once it's flowing.
If you get your big advance, or if you find some, you know, overnight success and you haven't done that, then you can find yourself playing catch up, and that's when you usually get in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what is the most common errors that you see new authors making?
They just don't know. They don't know enough about business. They haven't... They do good things. They reach out at conferences. They talk to other successful writers. But to some degree, that's like going to the gym and watching someone else that's having success and pumping weights.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really know why they're having that success. You learn, you talk, you go home and you try to duplicate it. And you may get lucky at it. You may not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of understanding what they want to accomplish, how they're going to do that, creating a system that's replicatable. So, you know, when they do grow and they have an assistant, when they have a corporation sized company now around their name, they can implement those things along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's really important to have a coach, like always have a coach and, you know, somebody who understands so that you can be led to, you can work toward, you know, a successful goal rather than just meandering and wondering, are you getting it right? You know, anything and everything that I do successfully, like I go get a coach and, you know, I do feel like an attorney, a literary attorney in particular, is a valuable coach because you're not just a writer, you know, with the art of writing, but you are a business entity. We teach our, you know, our clients and our participants to build their platform, you know, build their entity at the same time. And so you've got to take care of that.
And that's another oversight that
cry and scream and pull my hair out when I, you know,
they've written this
people
book
not managing
it's very, it's very personal to them. You know, they went within to create and now it's out, and it's hard for them unless they've set the system up to separate person from entity, from business. And so they go into contract negotiations with the wrong attitude. And they don't get what they need because it was personal. They couldn't separate themselves. They couldn't negotiate what they needed. They couldn't voice when they needed to voice because, oh, that hurt because they were attacking their baby. And so, again, it's just a matter of preparation and having more than a coach, more than a motivational coach, but a coach that's done it, that knows the system.
Exactly.
That knows how to help them identify the important stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that I've been so impressed with you, Mike, is that you are an author and then you do the literary attorney side of it as well. And so you have such an empathetic feel for what it's like. You know, you've actually done it. And I think that's probably fairly uncommon in the literary attorney world, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you think?
Yeah, there's not too many of us. I mean, there's a few on the coasts.
Yeah,
but in Utah, I haven't met too many other attorneys understand it and then also do it.
Yeah, yeah. So I would think that would be a huge advantage. You know, just being able to feel that. You know, feel the pain. Feel you understand the whole situation.
I'm just messing around with my hand. I'm not waving.
You're not flipping me off?
I'm not like, excuse me.
That comes later in the evening.
Excellent. So let's talk some more about Fog of Fortune and the soon to be, how soon? How soon is the sequel? You're focusing on too many things
it's
at once.
It's not a sequel. It's a different genre, darling.
You do have a sequel coming out to
Fog of Fortune. Oh, you have a sequel coming out to Fog of Fortune?
Yeah, if you had listened to the bio that I read.
Where was I at the beginning? What was I doing?
You're waving over there.
So tell us a little bit about Fog of Fortune and then fill us in on the sequel. What's coming?
So Fog of Fortune started out as a bedtime story for my son. And you know, that's common for writers, right?
Yeah.
So I lived in Missouri, and I would be driving to and from work, lots of driving, and so I would listen to books on tape and come home and then serialize them for my son's bedtime story. Mm. And one night, or one period, we did Treasure Island. And so we finished, and my son said, "Tell me another pirate story." And I said, "We live in a town of 1,200 people. The library has one pirate book on tape, and that was it." He says, he's eight, so he's like, "I don't care. Tell me another one." So yeah. I said, "Well, you really like Long John Silver, but I don't want to plagiarize his name, so let's name our pirate Jonathan Edwards." Edwards is an English name, so Jonathan Edwards is our pirate. And he always has his famous silver sword.
Yes.
Captain Silver Sword was born. And so we just kind of ran with him and ran with the story.
Uh-huh.
And a few years later, I was in Florida on vacation, and I said, "I need to write this story down." Mm-hmm. So used the beach as my muse and wrote the bedtime story and got done with it in a week and realized, yeah, it's too short. So book two, and this is why I labeled it book one and book two, came, you know, after to finish out the novel. But I designated it as book one because that's Ben's special story. Mm-hmm. And so, but it, you know, it answers the question or the question that I had in the back of my mind was, if a pirate doesn't take any prisoners and doesn't leave any witnesses and doesn't show any mercy, how do you know about him?
Mm.
So he's either full of junk and doesn't follow his own creed, or there's something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a fun adventure to flesh that out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Treasure Island, you know, style, you know, at first it was written much too like Treasure Island. It was too literary. It was too pretty. And as I queried it out and sent it to a bunch of agents and publishing houses, that was the feedback I was getting. This is beautiful writing. We can't sell it. And so I had to go back through and I hate to use the words dumb it down, but I modernized it. I made it
yeah,
more
we gotta
accessible.
Come up with another term besides dumb it down.
Yeah.
You know
what
I mean?
We've run into that a couple times, haven't we?
Yeah, we yeah. have.
Yeah. So you streamlined it.
I liked modernized
is good too. Yeah,
that works
modern
too.
Reader, because yeah. you know the modern reader wants the story to pick up and go and just mm-hmm. never look back.
Yeah.
I don't think The Hobbit would be published today.
I don't think so.
No,
either.
It wouldn't. And I mean, I'm
don't,
so.
It's don't like just The Hobbit, but
we
still.
Always talk about like the attention span of human beings has dropped because of video games and all of that. Like, but you know, really too, it's done us a service because we have like fine-tuned storytelling down to like distilled it down to what is powerful. Like we, you know, writers, we now know the elements of powerful storytelling as well. So
and what's mm-hmm. powerful to
you
us
know?
Today.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
And it does change over time. Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. So then book two is due out.
So book two, I wrote for NaNoWriMo a year ago.
Okay.
So it's written, it's, I know.
Is it in revision or are you?
It's in revision. That's a good way to say it.
It's resting right now.
I finished it right after, I released book one in 2014, October, and then I finished book two in NaNoWriMo that November,
mm-hmm.
and then got divorced.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So it's doing the kimchi thing. It's buried in the...
took a side. No, but it really did need... It needed to sit and breathe because since then I have... I did a revision of Fog and I'm about to upload that.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's some new parts to it, but it's just cleaner and better and I've caught some things that need
okay,
to change.
Great.
And at one point I was talking with a small publishing house and taking it in-house, but... I'm an attorney. I never liked the contracts. I'm sorry. But the revision got done, so now I need to upload it. And
there you go.
And then revisit book two, which I'm really excited about because the underlying theme of the book is disability. And the question is, what do you do when you can't do it on your own? Like you have this disability, whether it's mental or physical, and you can't get the job done. Who do you rely on? And so I get to really focus on that during this book too. I always have a theme like that for what I write.
Okay. Interesting. Well, cool. We'll look forward to that coming out sometime soon. We're not going to commit you to any time frame because we know how that goes.
My hope would be the fall.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. And then when's your nonfiction work coming out? I know that one's quickly coming to together.
So it's coming together really fast. If I self-publish it, it could be as early as spring. If I shop it out to agents, you know, them around their timetable.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I write this and as I share it with people, the overwhelming response that I get is, we need this book.
Mm-hmm.
So to reach a larger audience, it seems more appropriate to shop it to an agent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, good luck with that. We're excited.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the theme of You Failed at Marriage?
Yeah, so the idea here is in my humble opinion, the idea of hiring the bulldog attorney for the divorce and going for the jugular and what's mine is mine doesn't fit what your family's going to need in the next little while during your divorce process and then beyond the decree. My belief is that the divorce doesn't end the decree. It ends pretty much when you die. And so to succeed at marriage doesn't necessarily mean I did really good during the divorce and got what I needed, but to succeed means that you are continuing to build, to form, to strengthen, to repair relationships that came from the marriage, whether that's with your children, whether that's with your spouse, whether that's with your next spouse, because you've found healing from your first relationship and were able to find success in your next. Someone says, well, that's really harsh. You know, you failed at marriage. And I said, well, did the marriage end?
Yeah.
So that's the definition of a failure, right? So yeah. I do feel like I failed at marriage, but I don't feel like I'm a failure. And that's part of the message of the book, that the failed marriage does not equate to you being a failure unless you let it.
Mm-hmm. Awesome concept, and I agree with everyone else you've talked to that this book is needed. And it is such a departure from your typical legal advice that you get, right? You know,
it's hard because the ethical standard of the profession is to zealously represent your client.
Yeah.
And so an attorney is doing their job by kind of taking it to, you know, taking it as far as you can take it, because that's they're trying to protect their client and do what they're mandated to.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that's not necessarily what the client or their family
needs. It's not going to serve the client long term.
No.
Right, like maybe a fight, court battle, but...
That court... I mean, and there's no absolutes in any of this, and I have to be really careful with that, because there are times when court is necessary, and there are times when you do have to protect yourself and stand up for yourself, and there's cases of abuse and neglect, and those times may not apply to the general crux of the book, but the idea is to put yourself in a mindset, create a foundation, a theme for your divorce, and keep that mindset throughout and come back to it and revisit it and remember what your goal was and remember why you made those decisions, so you can make continuing decisions based on that rather than emotion, rather than fear, rather than frustration, because that works out so well.
Mm-hmm.
It really just makes attorneys money, because we get to go back to court and try to fix things in the wrong way, because whoever was happy about going back to court and telling it, having a judge tell them, well, now you have to do this.
Yeah.
Because that makes me really warm and fuzzy inside.
Yeah, I tell you. Should I not? I should stop.
Yeah, no.
Before I even start.
I would say that'd be a good idea.
Okay, like, I'm just going to paraphrase it. Like, I had this horrible experience on my birthday going back to court and watching my attorney lie, and then watching my ex-husband's attorney lie, and he and I looking across at each other like, you know, like Kramer versus Kramer, like, I didn't really say that. I didn't mean, you know, it was like, it was horrifying. And I was really glad to get that settled.
No, you can't.
I did. I actually did. And I've got my attorney pulling on my shirt, like, shut up. And I'm like, no, I'm talking now. Yeah, that's how that went. And you know, $1,000 later, right, for one day in court.
That's one of the focuses of the book, too. It's how to interview your attorney. It's how to work with him or her. It's how to create that rapport so they understand what is important to you and that they're going to do that rather than what they might feel is important for you.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what came out in court, like in the middle of this, was that she actually didn't know what had happened, you know, and she was trying to defend me against an accusation that wasn't even true. And had she really even known what went on. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Michael's looking at me like, stop talking now.
So, it's all about good communication with your attorney, too.
I think that's great. That is really great. And, you know, definitely a necessary book. And, you know, it's a good thing you're writing the book because you're going to lose business as an attorney. And so you need to make money from that book.
originally, the concept was when clients would come to me, you know, I fancy myself a good salesperson. So I would sell them on how to do this divorce. And at first they would, yeah, let's do it. That sounds great. But it's not easy. I mean, to choose to take the high road when the other party is undercutting you every step of the way, that is one of the most arduous situations you'll ever find yourself in. And it could last for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah.
And if you're not mentally prepared and really sure of your foundation, you'll fall along the way. And then who do you blame? Oh, your attorney. And so I really wrote the book originally, before I even knew I was getting divorced, almost as an education piece so my clients could understand what kind of service I wanted to provide for them.
Mm.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just kind of blossomed from there.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this thing about walking in, you know, somebody else's moccasins, right? Walk a mile in my moccasins. In fact, I had somebody today emailing me, asking me all kinds of questions about the rights and wrongs of this and that. And I just couldn't even answer. I'm like, you got to experience for yourself, you know, to really completely have empathy and understanding and to speak from a knowledgeable place. It really does make a difference to have some experience with that.
So, you know, one of the themes that I think has developed among our interviewees who are writers and published authors like you is that they really have just integrated the writing into their life. And that's what you've done is, you know, the bedtime story becomes the book and, you know, the need to educate clients then becomes the book. And I think that, you know, for all of our listeners out there is really one of the keys to success is to, you know, find that niche, that area of life that really just lights you up. And then writing just becomes a natural extension of that.
And it goes back to the very beginning. You asked about time. So when I'm doing anything in my life, whether it's the legal or writing or working at the restaurant, there's a synchronicity going on that it's all feeding back into each other. And so I'm doing practical research or I'm thinking about concepts and then putting thought to paper and so it just works out that way that you get a lot more accomplished when it's, you can't be an expert in everything. So,
be an
expert in some things and rely on your team for the rest.
Mm-hmm. Excellent advice. Any other questions that you would like us to ask?
Yeah, what do you want us to ask? Is there anything that you want to bring up?
That you want to promote? About? Anything that came from the panels this weekend that was a good question that you answered brilliantly?
Well, you know, we were in a business panel, a contract panel.
Mm-hmm.
It was the red light, green light, yellow light of contracts or working with publishers. And something that was apparent with me was we had a great panel. One guy has found great success in the writing world, but he's only experienced two contracts. And so while he was very knowledgeable about his own experience, I was scared for the audience because he's talking about one very specific experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a warning. It's like, make sure, don't just talk to one person because they found success, because usually people don't know why they were successful. Talk to someone who's failed.
Very good. Yeah. Somebody who's at the source of.
Or an attorney. Mm-hmm. And the concept came up, well, why don't I just rely on my agent?
Right.
And, you know, there's several reasons.
Just the same reason you don't just send your book out to one beta reader, too. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like you got to have somebody who has those eyes. I mean, you know, my agent, she was Harvard Law. And, you know, she's a great agent.
Attorneys.
Right, exactly. And she practiced law for 5 years. So, you know, that was one of the reasons I selected her, though. Right. And I still call you, like, for, you know, for a second pair of eyes on stuff. I mean, you know,
they have their place, but and they know the market and they know what will sell and they know what's standard in a contract, and that's great. But they don't know how that contract language will play out in a court situation mm-hmm. unless they've watched it specifically happen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, and, you know, a literary attorney charges you one time and you never have to pay him again. The agent's mm-hmm. going to take 10% forever.
Right, right, right.
So there's just different...
Or 15, right.
Whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just different modalities that you have to consider.
Right. Well, I always, I don't think I've had a contract that you haven't seen. I'm pretty sure.
It's always appreciated.
At one stage or another.
Yeah. No, I think it definitely is absolutely critical. And, you know, you're talking about medical advice or something like that. You're not going to go to a dentist for your heart, right? And that's just being in the business doesn't necessarily mean that you've got expertise in contracts. So I think that is very important.
The other takeaway from that panel was, again, this is a business. You know, these small publishing houses, hybrids, larger ones, they're not out to get you. They just want to make money and they want to make the most money for them, and they're going to make decisions based on that, and that doesn't always encompass your needs. Mm. Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand where they're coming from. They're not the big bad evil corporation. They just got to feed their family.
Yeah.
And if you don't respect the process and treat it as a business yourself, you're going to get run over.
Mm.
And it's kind of your fault.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's like an unhealthy expectation that you set yourself up for a fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you got to have a translator. You know what I mean? If you don't know the language, get a translator.
The other thing is, you know, we see a lot of new authors, budding authors, who are so excited. You know, this industry is so filled with rejection that if you get a bite, it's like you'll sign anything just because, oh my gosh, I got a bite from an agent. And I mean, have you seen these horror stories that come through? That
absolutely.
It's not necessarily a reputable agent or, you know, anything like that. That.
Well, again, if you go back to the premise that this is business, so that agent or that publishing house has gone to an attorney and they've had, you know, draft A, B, and C of a contract made, and they always present A because that gives them the most. And if there's any kind of negotiation, well, maybe we'll go to B or maybe C. And, you know, larger houses have more variations,
mm-hmm.
but they're always going to get A if you don't have a conversation, if you're not willing to sit down and most people think negotiation is a four letter word and you know, that's bad. You know, that's conflict. No, it's not conflict. It's negotiation.
It's
coming to the table, understanding three things: what I must have,
mm-hmm.
what I can live without, and what can, you know, happen in the middle ground.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know what those are coming into it, you're definitely not going to get it coming out.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times, you know, it's too close, it's too personal, and they need someone else to negotiate, whether it's an agent or an attorney. But most of the time, if they just know those three things, then they're gonna do okay.
Yeah.
But again, it just comes back to how are they doing business with me? You know, is this publishing house big enough to afford the attorney work to have those three contracts? Do I want to do business with them if they're not? You know, are they going to even have any money to market my book past signing the contract, because they don't really have any money in their business?
Yeah.
So things, you want to put them on question. You want to do your due diligence. You want to understand who you are getting into bed with.
And you want to know the questions to ask. You actually mm-hmm. want to discover what questions to ask.
Yeah.
Because you just don't even know.
Exactly.
You know.
Like if you see a clause that says, your rights will revert to you when your book goes out of print. And you feel good about that. You're like, okay, that's fair. But in today's market, an ebook never goes out of print.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that clause
print
is
on demand and
useless.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And you felt good about it and you felt like you were being protected, but in reality, it was a red herring.
Yeah.
You feel good about something that you weren't getting.
Interesting. The other thing that I was surprised to learn about as I've learned about this industry is that there are multiple rights You know, there's foreign rights, there's movie rights, there's audiobook rights, there's ebook rights, and those can be negotiated as a package deal or as separate things. And talk a little bit about all the different rights that are out there.
So I hate to quote my property professor in law school, but he had the best analogy, and in his speech it was about property, and this is more tailored to intellectual property. But the rights that you have is like a bundle of sticks, and there's a stick for each your foreign rights, your movie rights, your audio rights. And each one's a stick. And so when you go into that negotiation, you have to understand, or you have to have the goal in mind to retain as many sticks as possible to keep your bundle in your hands. And if you're going to give away one of those sticks, then you really want to understand what you're getting for it. Are they going to take your audio rights but have no responsibility to produce or market it? Are they going to take your film rights and then sell it to some third party for bottom, you know,
and who's going to make that movie?
Who's gonna so it's are you not be aligned bad with to that? Give it away, right. Right. But you need to understand what you're getting for it. And the trick is you have to understand the industry to know, well, that's good. You know, I'm getting this, and that's what the industry more or less gives me. So you don't get taken advantage of, not because they want to do that, but because they're going to try to get as much as they can. It's a business.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, it's as much about the exposure that you'll get as it is about being compensated for your work as well. Like sometimes it will serve you and you may not even see that it would serve you to actually sell that right along with, you know, the package.
Correct. And like I just was mentioning about the legal nonfiction, that to get maximum exposure to get the book out to many people, a traditional route's going to make more sense for me than self-publishing, but I'm going to give up some things to get that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Well, it is all a, you know, it's all a business. Everybody's in it to make money. You know, nobody's running this as a charitable organization. And I think understanding that
sometimes people do, it doesn't last long, but
yeah. Sometimes the authors are. No publisher ever is.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
So yes,
I'm just thinking. Like I know of a publisher that's in it for charity. I don't know. Maybe not.
Figure that out.
Well, that's Bravo. a one-off. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. All right. Yeah, I just have a problem always. Anytime we say, like, this is fact every time, 100%. Right, exactly.
An attorney's favorite answer is, it depends.
It depends. Well, and the point is not necessarily that okay, well, not every publisher is a, you know, for-profit entity, but the concept being that they do this because there's money to be made. Right. And that's okay because they're providing a service. They've got a reach. They've got a, you know, they've got distribution channels. They've got knowledge of the industry. And, you know, a good publisher can often be the best advocate that you have to get your book out there, like you were saying.
Okay. So I got to add something to that because this is what it is. It's that, you know, that's one of, and it's probably the primary in most cases, the primary goal is to make money. But, you know, also publishers are in publishing, and I'm thinking more like the smaller guys are in publishing because they love books and because they have an intention to, you know, have books be alive, reach kids that don't have access to books. Like there's all these other things too.
Oh, absolutely.
But the common thread from the top five all the way down to the little hybrid is money, right?
Well, even if that's the altruistic goal, which is awesome, and they're probably enjoying their job a lot more than others, but
it money, takes you
funding to make it go around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even the most successful nonprofits have a lot of money funneling through the system.
It has to. It has
exactly.
to.
And so you have to be interested also as an author in making money for your, you know, for the guy that's distributing your book and making it available.
Yeah.
You know?
And James Dashner did a panel over the weekend, and he said the thing that, one of the things that really changed for him is the day that he decided in his head, 5 years from now, I will be successful enough at my writing that I won't have to work at my day job. And I, you know, it's little things like that. It's making a marketing plan. It's making your 3-year success goal plan and writing it down that make things change.
Yeah. You know, what I like to say is like, the longer it's just in your head, the more chance it will be reabsorbed, you know, by the body. You got to get it out. You got to get it out. You've got to get it vocal. You know, it's like a seed, like a seed in a package is not going to turn into a tree.
On your mirror every day or on your phone, or, you know, there's power in that.
Excellent. Excellent. Any other questions you have?
Why is that cat chasing that bird? That's probably not the question you were looking for.
Existential.
I know. I thought it was a squirrel. I thought it was a skunk squirrel. It looked like a hybrid.
What's the sound of one cat clapping?
What's that cat's name? I can't even think of that cat's name.
And my kids think I'm James Bond. And I asked them why. And they said, because you don't really work. And I said, what do you mean I don't really work? They said, well, everything you do is fun. And you're always enjoying what you do. And you get to wear tuxedos a lot. And it doesn't seem like you work. And I said, well, that's because I love what I do.
Yeah.
I don't have to go answer to the man, or I don't have to go grind the axe. I just work every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. It changes the distinction, that word work, if you're enjoying it. Mm-hmm. You know, I only use the word work now in order to push the kids off and tell them I'm busy.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not working. I'm having a blast, right? I'm doing what I love. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't take something, but it's not work. It's never work.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Unless the kids need something from me and I do not want to provide right at that moment in the middle of something.
A deadline. Then it's
really, yeah. Then and then it's like, okay, it's work.
Yeah.
Because they understand that word, right?
So you're also an editor, right?
That's right.
How has that helped in your writing, and vice versa? How does your writing help as an editor?
So I found out later in life, well, I'm dyslexic.
Uh-huh.
And
all we brilliant people are, you know.
Reading was a challenge for me growing up. You know, I didn't like reading books because I couldn't read it as fast.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I was going to read a book, I'd have to like engross myself and then miss everything else, miss all the other fun that was going on around me. So I didn't read until two movies came out. One was Jurassic Park. And one was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Mm.
And then somehow the books got into my hands. And so I read the books after watching the movies. So the pictures held the words together for me.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I found for the first time, I knew I loved writing, but I found for the first time that I could love reading. And so, you know, flash forward into my adult life, as I would work on legal briefs or work on Fog of Fortune, I just really found that I love to take a story apart and help it be better, and not necessarily put my own voice into it, but to help another author find their stronger voice.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoy doing that. And you know, I can do line editing and have the English degree in the background in that. But what I really enjoy is taking their whole work and saying, well, this works here, this doesn't work there. Have you thought about this, and really working on the construct of it? And so I don't want to toot my own horn, but it's hard to find an editor that's willing
who can do the whole thing, right?
Do the whole thing, but to not put themselves into it.
Mm.
At the end of the project, it's still that author's book and not mine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's exciting for me to take something and make it better. And I've worked on personal memoirs. I've worked on other people's divorce books. I've worked on some sci-fi books, some crime thrillers, and it's kind of the same universal. Is I can take their book and as I'm going along, once I've read it, then I can go back and make some key changes or suggestions. I never change their book without their permission.
Sure.
But it's something that I've found that I really have a passion for, and so it's great to go in and help them see the potholes or see the story structure failings where it could be better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not all writers, you know, especially new writers, realize that there are various levels. Like, it's an onion. Like, there's the developmental, you know, edit that's very core, and then there's deep line where you're looking at you know, the sentence structure, the pacing, the voice, and like there's all these edits all the way to the grammatical, you know,
the copy edit. I did a little bit of that too. You know, I was reading someone's work today, and there were lots of was's and is's and you know, there's always a better verb.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that better verb will take out three or four words in that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Tighten it up, make it more impactful, make you sound better,
mm-hmm.
and without taking away your voice, because you meant to have that better verb, you just didn't choose it yet.
Mm. Right.
And so it doesn't take away their voice, it just strengthens it. And that's fun to find.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, how can our listeners get a hold of you if they would like to reach out to you for editing?
So I have the website is rockword.biz. Mm-hmm. It promotes my books, but it also has an editing page on there that they can reach out. It goes through the pricing structure, and I try to keep that very fair for writers. You know, there's always a couple pages that are free so they can understand how I'd work and what I'd give them. And you keep always want to see that. You always want to know, you know, he might be or she might be the best editor in the world, but if, much like attorney work, if we can't get along, then it's not going to be useful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very much eHarmony. It's, you know, your editor's a partner with you.
Mm-hmm.
And final parting words of advice for our audience.
I'm a single guy. And when I date, some women have an issue with my writing because that takes time. And that takes time away from things that they might want me to do or and I have to explain, well, if you like me is a direct result of being able to have that writing part of me. Writing is who I am.
Mm.
And so I would say to writers, don't be ashamed. Don't give that up. Don't sacrifice that part of you for something else, because then you might be surprised that you're not you anymore.
Mm.
That's really great.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Mm-hmm. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Mike.
It was fun.
We really enjoyed you.
We just love you.
Yeah. Yeah. Get those books out. We'll have you back on.
All right.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe so that you get each new episode as it comes out. You can find all of our episodes and show notes at calliopepodcast.com. Don't forget to shoot some stars our way if you like the show.